The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the University of Alberta, the Students' Union, or CJSR.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell, and I am back from Las Vegas. Now, I can never tell who out in audience land is here for the science and who's here for the skepticism, so let me just say, the amazing meeting lives up to its name. An event that involved 1,300 enthusiastic skeptics in one place can't really be described in any brief way. But rest assured, you'll be hearing from some of the phenomenal people I met there in upcoming interviews. So on to today's episode. We're joined by a gentleman who's been called the Indiana Jones of entomology, explorer and wildlife photographer, Mark W. Moffat. We'll be talking about his new book, Adventures Among Ants. But let's start with some more family-friendly fare on Speaking Up. We're here with Mike McCarron, Ontario massage therapist, husband of one, and father of two. And Mike wants to speak up about making skepticism a family affair. Welcome, Mike.
Hey, thanks, Desiree. It's great to talk to you. You know, you always sound great because you always sound like you're kind of just barely containing a humongous smile.
That would be because I'm actually doing it.
It's a nice vocal quality.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
So why skepticism in the family?
Well, I think it's important to kind of give your kids the tools that they need to learn about the world around them and ask the right questions and go get the answers initially with mom or dad or both, and eventually on their own in whatever ways that you can kind of point them towards so that they'll have the resources.
So do you think that this is something that maybe we're not doing enough of as a society?
A little bit. I think so. Yeah. I mean, I've met too many adults through the run of my massage therapy career and my other careers, where there's just not that curiosity there. I mean, when you see something or a news story, when someone learns something that they didn't know before, or more accurately, when they hear something that they don't understand, they just kind of go, oh, that's funny or that's weird. And that's the end of it. And they never go kind of look deeper and try and actually learn about it. And it seems obvious to me, maybe it's not this way, but it seems kind of obvious that if your parents are like that, or if the adults are like that, they're just not going to pass that curiosity on to their kids. You know, it's going to be a cycle, if you will.
So you're saying that curiosity is actually the key to skepticism?
For sure. I think so. It's curiosity and it's having the critical thinking tools to know what to do with that curiosity. You can be a curious ghost hunter. I just listened to the Ben Radford episode today, and he was talking, you know, about the EMF meters and stuff. And you can be curious and think there's ghosts and go get an EMF meter and find them, or so you think. But if you don't have those critical thinking tools to evaluate what you're doing and what you're seeing and what you're hearing, you could fall into those traps that he was talking about.
So how do you go about teaching a child the scientific method?
I think you don't call it the scientific method from the get-go. I think just teaching them the steps and kind of going through the observation and the hypothesis and the experiment, but not calling it that. Just saying, what do you see over there? What do you think that is? Well, let's go check it out and try and find it out. And then, you know, you look at your results and you come to a conclusion and, you know, you go ask mom or you check it out. You do the peer review thing, but in its weird little kid kind of world where you go check other resources and see if what you came up with actually jives with what the library says or the internet says or whatever. And you can take them through the steps of the scientific method and teach them how to do it. And then when they get older, they're going to actually learn and go, oh, that's what we were doing with, you know, I was doing with dad, or I was doing with mom, or they'll learn it. They'll just get professional about it, or I shouldn't say professional. They'll get specific about it later.
So give me an example.
Okay, so an example would be, we came home from the zoo the other day and we were driving in the car and we had just come back. It was sort of mid-afternoonish, and a lot of the animals weren't out in their cages kind of running around doing their thing. And when my daughter, who's three, she asked why. So we tried to explain to her the concept of nocturnal and what nocturnal animals meant. And once we told her that they were animals that kind of come out at night, then we asked her to try and think of some animals that had that behavior. And when we did, I should preface this by saying my son's name is Gabriel and he's only 4 months old. So when we asked her what animals were nocturnal, she started out by saying, well, sometimes maybe owls. We said, oh, that's good. That's a good one. But what's another one? She said, well, maybe sometimes bats. We're like, yeah, that's very good. Bats, excellent. Can you think of any more? And she said, sometimes Gabe. And of course, we all laugh because Gabriel wakes up through the night because he's 4 months old and it's annoying to all of us, but he's 4 months old, so it's cute.
Is it more important to have the sort of interactive aspect of it?
I think so. I think it's important for her to be able to ask questions and have them always taken seriously and answered the way I'd talk to anybody else who was a peer, but just used language that she can understand. And when she asks, I mean, it gets to the point where she asks the same question again and again. And as long as you answer it once, then you can flip it back on her and say, well, we've already talked about this. What's the answer to that? And then get her to answer it. And usually she does after the fourth or fifth time. But by that time, it's actually, you know that it's actually sinking in and she's understanding stuff. So, you know, she has a little doctor kit downstairs and she's using the stethoscope. And because of that, when you use the real actual terms, she knows what a stethoscope is now. She knows what an otoscope is now. She knows terms that she, you know, a three-year-old usually wouldn't know. But it's just because we use the proper terms for things. And that goes for body parts and nature parts and any other parts, as long as you answer her questions properly at an age-appropriate level.
So are there other issues that maybe we don't think about on a regular basis that you could use critical thinking to look through?
The one example I guess I can think of for that, and I don't think this is something that maybe we don't all use because this is more of a reality kind of science-based mindset, but when Sophie was, I want to say, cooking in utero, developing, we had to do a blood test or whatever it was, and it came back with a high level of some specific protein. I can't remember what it was, but the indication for what that was potentially spina bifida, which is potentially super serious and crazy deformative in some cases. And I think if you're more of a, I don't want to say faith-based or whatever, but if you don't have that basis in scientific mindset or critical thinking, then you end up asking the why question. Why me? Why did this happen to my kid? Why is this going to happen potentially? Instead of, okay, well, potentially this might have happened. We're going to have to go for another test. It's probably not going to happen. It's probably a false positive. Even if it is, it's kind of a genetic lottery. You don't want to win thing, and it happens, and it's sad, and it sucks. And you deal with it on that level, which makes it a lot easier, I think, as opposed to the why is it happening to me question, which is unanswerable and ultimately just kind of tortures you.
Well, it seems like it would be harder to think critically, especially in terms of your family, when it is an emotional issue.
For sure, for sure. But I think that's where the training over the years of being in that kind of mindset comes in. And it is, I think it is training. I think it takes a lot to get to the point where you're very comfortable being wrong all the time and being able to kind of look at yourself and your family and your friends in that kind of way and be comfortable in the knowledge that you're kind of floating. You know, Richard Feynman said, I'm comfortable in a world of uncertainty. It takes a lot to get to that point because a lot of people have a lot invested in another kind of worldview, and it's hard to let go of that.
So one of the things, though, that we hear as parents is that it's up to us to make sure that we provide some sort of structure for our children, and we want to let them know that sort of that we're in control because it provides comfort to them. Mm-hmm. So in this context, when you're saying, well, I don't know, how do you think that works, I guess, long term?
I think having your kids know that you don't know everything is a good thing, as long as when you say, I don't know, it's followed by, let's go find out. And you use that as a teaching opportunity to go learn about it together. And whether you look it up on the internet or find an encyclopedia or go to the library or make an appointment with your doctor and go ask them or go to the museum, every time you say, I don't know, is an opportunity to go learn with your kid. And you kind of have to teach them that so that when they think, I don't know that, let's go find out is going to be their next thought. So when they get into school, when they say, I don't know, their next trip is to the library or to the teacher or to whoever, and they're going to find that out. I know you do this because you look up every idiom that you don't know on the internet. And I'm the same way.
I do.
Well, my wife does that all the time because we'll say something, you know, she'll make something up or ask me a question, all that. I don't know. And she knows that in the next 10 minutes, I'm going to be on Google looking it up. And it's a point of humor at this point because I'm such a nerd about it.
So it's creating that sense of curiosity and enthusiasm about that curiosity.
About learning about everything, which I think is really, really important. To be curious about everything to the point of fault with respect to myself because it's hard to focus on something that you're actually interested in. But as long as you find something that you love and you're interested in with respect to your kids, teaching them that you can find a way to make a living at that thing is really important, but still maintaining the interest and curiosity about pretty much everything else.
So when you're in these situations with your child, when you are trying to encourage them to be curious, or you're asking or answering these questions, are there particular people that you emulate? Because myself, I tend to oscillate between the mother from Edward Scissorhands and Sarah Connor. So it really depends on the situation.
You're going to take them out and carve their name in a picnic table with a buck knife? Nice.
Saying I oscillate, when you're playing that skeptical dad role, who are you channeling?
That's a hard one to answer, because there's people that I think emulate rather than channel, because the people that I try to are way better than me. The first one probably would be Sagan, Carl Sagan, because my sort of drop into skepticism is exactly like 95% of everybody else's, was the demon-haunted world that a friend of mine or a colleague of mine gave me when I was actually living in Japan and hungry for reading material. He actually dropped that book off, and that's the thing that really made me turn the corner into sort of a curious, because Sagan's books are great for that, and so is Richard Feynman's books. Curious about everything, but very specialized within their own realm, and a great knack for explaining ridiculously hard concepts in language that a dude like me can understand. There's a great passage in one, I can't remember which of his books, but one of Feynman's books about his dad. And when Feynman was little, he had a ball in a little red wagon, and he had pulled the wagon and the ball rolled to the back and hit the back. And he asked his dad why that happened. And there's a great story about his dad explaining, well, nobody really knows, but if you look, the ball doesn't actually roll backwards. It moves forward. And it's a really good explanation about inertia. And it's simple, but it's correct. And that's the kind of thing you want to sort of pass on to your kids, is that no matter how difficult the concept is, you can get it into their heads in a way that they're going to understand it. Neil deGrasse Tyson's another one. He's got a great attitude and a great way of explaining things, I find, that doesn't go over people's heads, but it still gets the main points of whatever you're talking about into the person's head.
So you actually write a blog about this, correct?
Yeah, I do. Well, I have two. I have one that I've had for a while, that the Mike's Weekly Skeptic Rant one, which I suck at upkeeping. But every now and then I'll throw something up there. Usually it's something, if it's something annoys me to no end, or if I find something amusing, that'll go up there. I just started a new one, which is going to be sort of a dad blog, which is called Isn't It Cute, which the first post explains the title. I don't know if I'll go into that at the moment, but that's going to be more of sort of an interacting with my kids and get into some of the stuff that we've been talking about.
And so where can people find that?
That's at isntitcute.wordpress.com.
Perfect. Thanks, yeah, Mike, and keep it up.
I'll do what I can, you know. Thanks.
And we'll be right back with more Skeptically Speaking after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. You can email your questions for next week's episode to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, we're at Skeptical Radio, or use our handy question submission box on the website at skepticallyspeaking.com. After the show, continue the conversation in the comments section of the website or check out our Facebook group. You can also subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, and while you're there, why not add a review of the show? Skeptically Speaking is rebroadcast on a number of wonderful radio stations. Check the media page at skepticallyspeaking.com to see if we air near you. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. I'm on the line with Dr. Bugs himself, Mark W. Moffat. An explorer, ecologist, and photojournalist, Mark has discovered new species and behavior while risking life and limb to find stories that make people fall in love with nature. His most recent book is Adventures Among Ants, a global safari with a cast of trillions. Welcome to Skeptically Speaking, Mark.
Hey, Desiree. How is it up there in Edmonton?
It is rainy, sir.
Oh my gosh! Well, I'm roasting down in New York, and it's not good weather here for ants. So I'm looking to take off to the tropics again as soon as I can.
Back to the rain, or
back to the warm rain.
So, Mark, after reading your book, I realized that I was terribly, terribly misinformed as to ant behavior, and I blame Pixar.
Oh yes, well, I believe you're talking about the fact that ants have six legs. No, Pixar got that one right. Pixar confused the fact that ants are, in fact, essentially all female. Is that what you're talking about?
Actually, I'm talking about A Bug's Life and ants. They're misleading.
Yes, well, what can you do? These animators never come to me. They really should.
Well, let's talk about some of the misconceptions. Starting with the Queen. Turns out she's not very royal.
Well, she's not very royal. She gets the royal treatment, though. Everybody gathers around her and keeps her clean and tidy and makes sure she turns into an egg-laying machine, which doesn't really sound very exciting. So she gets kept in the dark and essentially does nothing all day but lay eggs. It's not the most thrilling job, but essential to the colony because everybody in the colony is her offspring. Her young daughters, as it were, are the workers.
Well, how exactly does one become a queen?
Well, in ant terms, it's basically how much you're fed. Worker ants, nurses, feed the young, which are larvae, and those that get fed the most grow the most. And at a certain point, a critical size, they switch to become queens. And those individuals are usually, in North America, formed only in the spring when the young queens emerge in mating flights.
What decides whether one becomes a queen or a worker?
Simply the matter of food. You know, at least in honeybees, they get that royal jelly, which sounds like fun. Ants simply, the workers feed the ones that become queens, get fed the most, grow the largest, transform from a life of servitude as workers to a life of servitude laying eggs as queens. Not really actually that much different. But the queens at least have that mating flight. They have their moment of sexual glory in midair, and then they land and form new colonies.
And there's also different kinds of workers.
There are. Depends on what colony you're born into, Desiree. There are ants that have only a single kind of worker, and then as societies get bigger in the ants, there's more division of labor. So some kinds of ants have quite a few kinds of workers, and those, again, depend on their size. So ants of different sizes are grown, and the small ones are usually become the menial worker caste, and various large ones can do different jobs. Some of the large ones, for example, become soldiers in many species.
So in your book, there's an image, and it's a gorgeous image, I might add, of an ant carrying a piece of a centipede. And then there's another ant lifting up the end of the centipede so that it doesn't drag. And then there's another ant that's lying in a pothole so that the load can be carried over top of it. Now, that is cooperation, sir.
Yes, indeed. I'm glad you like that image. That's my idea of the ideal nature image. I think a lot of nature photography gets stuck in the past with sort of calendar pictures, very simple images. And the idea for me is to get kind of a journalism to it, to get a whole story. And here I managed to get most of the work done in these army ant colonies in a single picture, and it turns out, as you say, the smallest of the ants in the colony get stuck with this unusual labor as pothole fillers. They actually lie down in pits along the roadway and fill them up with their own bodies, and everyone else gets to run over them all day.
Now, since there are these different roles, how do they know how to do that? Like, is that common, first of all?
Is that common? Well, some colonies are simpler than others. The army ants have quite a few different roles. They're more intricate that way. I like to compare life in even human societies. A small village will have maybe a small number of jobs, and you move to someplace like New York City or London, and you get like thousands of kinds of jobs. So the number of roles increases with the size of societies of both ants and humans. And these most complicated societies in ants really have an extreme division of labor where some of the workers actually do very simple things repetitively all day, sort of like factory work.
So is that common for ants to lie in potholes? Because honestly, before that image, I had never even heard of that.
Oh, the pothole thing. Well, no, it's only known for this particular species. I would say if you are reincarnated as an army ant, this is probably the ideal one to be reincarnated as. Most of the other ants have to go out and actually do battle and get killed a lot. Pothole ants at least have a rather bland day. day by day lying in potholes. They also do other quotidian tasks around the colony, but mostly they don't get killed as much as some of the other workers.
We have a chat room question.
Do members of the colony not destined to become the queen ever become fertile? If so, how often, and what is the result? That's from Mystic 99.
Oh, good question, Mystic 99. Well, there are ants in which there can be disputes about reproduction. These are usually ants that are considered somewhat primitive, near the base of the evolutionary tree of ants. And they often have small colonies where there can be disputes over the rights of reproduction. And sometimes when the queen dies, one of those workers can actually turn into the new queen. And it depends on the species. There can be a fair amount of dispute. Sometimes there are actually police that go around and make sure that no workers get away with reproduction. No workers are laying eggs. So they have their own safety net to make sure the queen has the sole reproductive rights. And if there's any disputes about it, those workers can sometimes actually be killed for it.
Audience, you're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and we're here with Mark W. Moffat, who has forgotten more about ants than you will ever know. Email live at skepticallyspeaking.com or tweet us at Skeptical Radio. Let's go back to talking about that cooperation aspect. You spoke about ants being a superorganism.
Yes, well, this is a metaphor that's used fairly commonly. It's actually an old metaphor, over a century old. It's the idea that a colony can unite, in a sense, to act as if it's an organism. All the individuals form in combination a single organism with the queen sort of the reproductive part of the body. And that's particularly true of ants over, say, human societies, because ants unite absolutely. They have a kind of nationalism that cannot be broken. The workers, if they dispute reproduction, as I said, can be killed, but they can't decide to leave and form their own colony. They are part of a united society. And you can't defect to Canada over a war in an ant society, for example. And this makes them very cohesive and strong and makes their capacity for working together extremely strong, perhaps stronger than people's.
When I was reading your book, I couldn't help but think of quantum mechanics, honestly, that matter is both a particle and a wave.
Yes.
Is that similar to ants? Ants are both individuals and a piece of a larger organism.
Well, yes, it's certainly true, Desiree. The ants as an individual certainly is an individual, and that's one thing that I talk about with people all the time, because they look down, they see these little ants. They don't look like they have much personality, but I'm going like from an airplane or the top of a Ferris wheel, people look like dots. They have no personality at all. You got to get down close. You got to get your eye down to soil level, right with me. That's where I am. And then you see all the individual differences. But even so, those individual ants don't have, of course, too much to say. And what emerges from the whole society is much more complicated and unexpected, because the individual ants often know very little or nothing about what's going on. And yet there are no leaders. And without leaders, the colony as a whole still makes smart decisions.
Well, how does that happen? Because, you know, in addition to the fact that they do work together so intricately in such complexity, ants are blind. So, like in the situation with the ant with the pothole, how does it even know to do that?
Well, we're all born with certain capacities. Sometimes we don't realize there are limitations. A human cannot decide to be act like an earthworm. No one ever has. And ants are ants. And we have a lot more latitude in what we do than an ant does. But basically, ants have, you know, a large number of instincts that are formed in their brain from birth and they can't get away with. They still have choices in some cases. Ants actually sometimes take on as individuals of one task versus another. One will become very good at, say, searching for food of a certain kind. And like a person practicing the violin, they'll become an expert at it over time. So there are differences from ant to ant. But what happens more importantly is that all these ants, even though most of them are pretty ignorant about virtually everything, the small decisions they make in huge numbers lead to the right outcome. And a group as a whole can choose the best food that's the closest and most convenient, even though no ant knows where that food is.
So do ants truly ever operate independently?
Well, they can, and that's particularly true, I would say, in some of the species that have smaller colonies where individual choices matter more. So there are ant species, for example, that have colonies of a dozen or two, sort of like a human hunter-gatherer group. Everybody has to have the capacity to do everything on their own in that case. There can't be all this fancy division of labor just because there aren't enough workers around to divide up the labor. And when something happens, that ant has to be able to do what's in front of it without help. So those ants often have a tool chest built into their face to get all the work done, and they operate quite effectively on their own.
You mentioned that there is a group of ants, and I can't remember the name for the life of me right now, but that the largest colony is 4 members big?
Well, it's not likely you will remember Thaumatomyrmex. Yes, it's a species or a group of species from South America that are extremely notoriously difficult to find. And many people have spent their whole lives and only seen one. I went out with a crack crew of ant searchers once in Ecuador, and we found our designated single individual. Very cool. And that one has these elaborate mandibles with these long prong-like teeth. And these jaws are used to hold onto their prey, which are a kind of millipede that looks like a porcupine that virtually nothing else can eat because of its long spines. And so this ant with a special tool chest is able to catch these tiny millipedes and strip them of their hairs and eat them. And it does this in very small colonies, 4 at most.
We have a question from the website.
Do the emergent properties of ant colony behavior merely mimic intelligence, or does the colony really have the ability to think as a unit?
Well, interesting question. Of course, the question is whether, for example, groups of mindless neurons in our brain mimic intelligence or intelligence emerges from it. And in fact, you could almost say both about brains and ant colonies. The fact is you get enough ants together interlinked with their limited information and smart choices come out of it just as they come out of the human brain, at least most of the time. And this is actually fascinating because it allows us to actually look in parallel at the way a brain might be formed out of all these neurons and an ant colony might be formed out of all these individual workers. And some of the properties might be quite similar.
So how much of that is just stimulus response then? Any idea?
Well, stimulus response is, of course, important both for neurons and individual worker ants. Neurons particularly just have sort of a yes-no, I'm firing or I'm not firing. Of course, ants are smarter than neurons. They have their own little mini-brains, and they have specialized labor, and they do things, and they move around independently. So they're a little more than stimulus response. They can actually, I think, have a kind of a personality. You can actually, if you watch ants long enough, and I certainly have, you will notice differences from one to the next. Some ants tend to be lazy bums. Some ants do too much of the work and probably, I don't know if they get irritated about it or not, but they have to kind of nudge the other lazier ants along to get things done. A lot of the kind of differences you see in human societies emerge in ants.
Well, how much do we actually know about ant cognition? To the best of my knowledge, we don't have tiny little ant fMRIs yet. So how much of this is just speculation?
Oh, well, speculation, I don't know. I'm just telling you what I'm observing. And what it means in terms of what's going on in an ant's brain is always a trick. That's always the question, even about human brains. But I can tell you that personality in terms of individual differences do emerge among ants. And those are actually quite important in the formation of ant colonies, potentially. So ants can actually gain different expertises. They actually are born with other expertises, like the different sizes and so forth, that go in different directions. But actually what's going on in there in terms of thought is beyond our comprehension so far.
We have another question from the chat room.
Do ants have any intercommunication method akin to the bee dance that guides other hive members to flowers?
Well, yes, ants do. Ants don't dance. I wish they did. Sometimes they do something similar to a dance, but it's usually on the battlefield, actually. But most of the time, at their size, it pays to use odor. Little scent molecules can be emitted in bursts, indicating, for example, that there's a prey to be caught, that we should walk in this direction to a new battlefield, that there's a new nest to be built. And so ants are often signaling each other with odor molecules of various kinds called pheromones. This is their favorite technique. They sometimes use sound transmitted through the ground. And they sometimes use a bit of sight or touch. Some of them do see rather well. Most of the advanced ants are close to blind.
So let's go back for a moment to ant pheromones, because that's actually, to me, one of the most fascinating things about them. What kind of proximity are we talking about?
Well, the neat thing about pheromones is, depending on the molecule, you can use them in all kinds of different ways. There are pheromones that need to be transmitted really fast and disperse very fast. So if you suddenly are in contact with an enemy, you need an instant response, because you need those nearby workers to converge fast and kill it. You need something that disperses quickly in the air. And that's usually a very temporary situation. And so those scents usually disappear and disperse quickly. But if you need to have a whole army go out to a warfare zone, or if you found a really great piece of food, you will lay down a trail that has a longer life, a kind of molecule that will stay there and be sensed for a longer period of time. And other ants will reinforce that and make sure it lasts for quite a while. In fact, the more ants that go out and the better the food is, the more ants send back this signal and the highway builds up that can become permanent.
So you've actually done experiments with pheromones in ants.
Well, I've done a few. I actually have tried to figure out some the roles of the scent glands of a certain ant called the marauder ant that I worked on my thesis in Southeast Asia. And these ants have fantastic division of labors and huge colonies in the hundreds of thousands that can go out and catch prey. And they had I had to go out in the field and dissect out the tiny glands from their back ends with a microscope and lay them down and see what the ants did. Unfortunately, it was in an area where the monkeys all were watching me, and they started to throw rocks. So I remember trying to figure out how to do these delicate experiments with rocks flying by on all sides. But fortunately, macaques don't aim very well.
We have a caller. Caller, are you there?
Yes.
And who are we speaking to?
This is Jonathan.
Hi, Jonathan. What's your question?
I'm just curious. Are there any other insects aside from ants and, I suppose, bees with societies that are this structured and complex? And if so, what are they?
Well, good question, Jonathan. The other contender is a major contender are the termites, which in some cases can have huge societies. You may have seen films about the termite mounds of Africa and Australia, which can be enormous. But really, between those few termites and many kinds of ants, there are no similar situations. In fact, for that reason, I think ants can, in many cases, be more like humans in the way they structure their societies, even than our closest relatives, the chimpanzees, because chimpanzees only have small groups of a dozen up to, in exceptional cases, maybe 100 individuals. They don't have to deal with issues like infrastructure, moving goods and services around, and all kinds of other things that ants have as a problem.
That's a bold assertion, sir.
Oh, well, no, it's a matter of the emergence of issues that come with large group size. For example, a group of chimpanzees can move over a large area. It usually doesn't have to, they don't ever have to deal with issues of public health and waste management, but ants actually spend a lot of time dealing with the health of the colony. They actually build highways. A small group of hunter-gatherers, humans, chimpanzees, or whatever, don't need a highway. You get bigger, and you need an infrastructure. You need a well-set home. You start collecting lots of excess food, so you get food stockpiles and so forth, and you need to figure out how to deal with that. So all these things are fairly unique to very large groups. They don't suggest intelligence. They suggest aspects of life that have to do with complexity and size. And it's similar with organisms. The bigger an organism is, if you start out with an amoeba and look at a hydra and some insects and go up to humans, we get more and more complicated body structures that have to deal with things like our own health, the movements of toxins out of our body, and the dispersal of food to the different organs of our body. All these things come about as an organism gets bigger, and it similarly happens when an ant colony or a human society gets bigger.
If you have questions for Mark W. Moffitt, author of Adventures Among Ants, email live@skepticallyspeaking.com or tweet us at Skeptical Radio. Mark, you've actually discovered new ant behavior.
Well, I've been lucky enough to see a few things over time. There are, well, for example, there was a species of what I call mud ant. It's a Basoceros ant that covers itself with mud. Very small colonies. They move very slow. They're the slowest of the ants, perhaps. They move at glacial speeds, and this species hadn't been studied before. But it turns out that they're quite sensible in their speed and their choice of prey. They catch snails for a living. And it's, you know, a pleasure as someone who actually does things for National Geographic, including photography. Normally with ants, there's just this mass all around you, and they're scurrying up your body, trying to bite you at the same time you're trying to get your research done or take your pictures. And these ants, you can just lean back with a beer, look over, and watch them slowly chase the snail all afternoon and take a picture occasionally. Oh, such relaxation.
Actually, one of the things that I was very interested in was the marauder ants. How are they different from army ants?
Well, the marauder ants are a group of ants that I noticed when I started graduate school. They were in a collection, and there were all these different sizes of them, which always indicates that there's a lot of division of labor. As we say, the different sized worker ants indicate different specialities. So I knew they had to have complicated social structures, but nobody had studied them before, it turns out. There were a few early notes. And I found out they did have swarm raids, which are what many army ants have. These ants go out in large battalions that can be several meters wide and move forward as a group, sort of like a Roman troops along a battlefield, and sweep up and kill everything they can get along the way. And the marauder ants did that. And this was a remarkable situation of convergence. They had their own way of making their kills, though, which was quite fun. And so I got to see a lot of death and destruction as a graduate student, which, of course, as a boy growing up watching ants, I enjoyed immensely.
We have a phone call. And this is Kyla?
No, Tyler.
Tyler.
Yes. I'm just wondering, all these different species of ants that have colonies, how do they act to each other? Do they usually compete against each other, or?
Oh, good question. Good question, Tyler. Yes, yeah. Indeed. The ants are actually very competitive with each other, both the different societies of their own species and the different species. So ants actually lay out the ground and the treetops, because they move right into the trees, as if it would look a lot like the map of Europe. And with the territoriality well established, and some of the larger societies have large-scale warfare, and they fight both their own kind in other societies and other competing species very fiercely. Famously, of course, ants have their stingers, and some of them use those mostly on each other. The standard method of warfare is often grabbing onto each other and slowly pulling each other apart, which is quite painful to watch as arms pop off here and antennae there. But sometimes they're a little more sneaky than that. There are various techniques among the ants.
We actually have a related website question.
I've read that ant colonies sometimes compete against each other in a way that's similar to competition between individuals in another species. Is it possible that natural selection could operate on ants at the colony level and not just on individual ants? Could a whole colony evolve together?
Indeed, that's a big area of research, because ant societies basically act as units on the evolutionary scale. It's one thing Darwin was concerned about, because Darwin noted that only the queen reproduces. So what are all these workers doing through natural selection? They should go extinct. But in fact, because the colony acts like a unit, it's the success of the whole colony that matters. That's why ants are such good kamikazes. Unfortunately, they will kill themselves at a moment's notice for the good of their society. And it doesn't matter. So if you decide to kill some ants that invade your home, it's almost inconsequential to most ant societies. Only the queen really matters. The only way to stop them is to get to the queen, and they defend her to the death.
Well, since we're talking about competition and war, basically, I'd like to point out that swarm raids are brutal. Your photos are both stunning and frightening. And actually, in your book, you talk about the first time that you investigated a marauder nest. And I would love you to share that story, because I felt like I had ants crawling on me after I
Oh, Desiree, come along with me. It's quite an experience. You know, as I just said, ants are very territorial, and they're very concerned about anybody getting near their queen, which means if you go out looking for a marauder ant queen, which is a society in the hundreds of thousands, you're in for some trouble. And these are ants nest in the base of trees. And I first tried this with a shovel, and I figured out they were going to give me some difficulties. So I made sure I wore long pants and long shirts, and I tucked my socks over my pants and kept my shirt tucked in tight. And that way, the first ants to get to me had to climb all the way up to my hands and neck, which took them a little while. And so you start chopping into the nest with your pickaxe and shovel, and they start pouring out. And soon they reach your neck, and you have to run away and scrape them off. And then you run back and dig a bit more, and then you run out and scrape them off. And as you do this, they get spreading farther and farther from the nest, and you've knocked more of them off farther from the nest. So by the time you've found the queen, you have to do these long jogs to an ant-free zone, and you'd get the queen, and there's the joy, because she is deep in the nest, well-defended, and the mother of them all, and you begin to see how they put their lives together down there. It's, you know, it's a city.
Are you ever frightened at all of this? Do you have any fear of insects at this point?
Fear of insects? My goodness, no. My problem is being down on the entomologist compromising position on my hands and legs with my hands and feet with my butt in the air, excuse my French, and having an elephant come up behind me, which I actually had once. And this is a bit of a shocker for an entomologist. I actually looked up from my ants and see this towering beast over me looking down at me, and I remember the slow blink of its eye before, fortunately, it decided it was more frightened of me than I was of it, and the elephant took off through the rainforest of Thailand and left me be, my heart beating. And I thought about how huge I must look to an ant by comparison, even to that elephant.
And I understand that elephants are larger, but there is something to insects, that creepy crawly feeling, and especially when you describe things like you watching ants ripping up, what is it, a live 2-centimeter-long frog.
Well, yes, there is some of that, I suppose, but I have an infinite capacity to be munched on by ants, as my colleagues report. They stand around and watch me doing these excavations and wonder how I do it. What happens is that I get totally enthralled with what's in front of me, and I kind of forget everything else, including perhaps the other parts of my body. And I'm famous at National Geographic for getting a different part of my anatomy into every article I do for them. So for the first article on marauder ants, I had my lower leg, and I've had fingers and thumbs and arms and every bit of me, almost every bit of me, has been in National Geographic now. You could actually piece me together from the different articles I've done.
Now, we've been talking about competition, and I mentioned war. So how do wars usually happen?
Well, wars and ants come from a lack of space, as they do with humans. Free space is the enemy of warfare, as one military theorist put it, and it's the same with ants. Ants fill up space, and when the density gets high enough, as it did with human societies, like in Europe early on, warfare's just emerged. And those can occur along battlefronts. There are most amazingly battlefronts going on now around San Diego of the Argentine ant, which have the hugest colonies ever measured. Those colonies of those ants can be in the billions and cover many square miles, and they converge in certain neighborhoods in San Diego and run for miles, these territorial lines, these border disputes, and a million ants can die a month along some of these territorial borders, all underfoot, in the grass, out of view.
You've actually written, I love this statement, unless they are diverted to kill prey en route, the ants are committed to a single goal, to follow fresh trails leading ultimately to unexplored terrain.
Ah, yes. Well, that's from Adventures Among Ants has a lot to say about the army ants, and that's from that section. And the army ants are really stripped down, even for ants. There's not a lot of individuality between those little army ants. There can be millions of them in a colony, and they follow the scents of their neighbors, and they don't deviate. They have little capacity to go anywhere on their own at all, so they stay in a tight formation, including at these battlefronts, which in their case are predatory battlefronts. They will kill other kinds of prey, and they will kill other ants. They will kill whatever they can. And this keeps them, this tight formation makes them really look a lot like an organism just because they're so unified in space. Other ants, of course, can spread out. A single ant can enter your kitchen, find some food, and run off and inform its friends. In army ants, that doesn't happen. Everyone is always tight together.
Well, that's interesting because you spoke about sort of the parallels to human society, and you actually compared this to the Romans.
Well, it is, and the kind of formation that the army ants use and the marauder ant has some parallels to the Romans. The use of these tight formations that sweep forward. The Romans did certain things the ants didn't do. They tended to stay in certain kinds of subgroupings that ants don't show very well. But otherwise, there are lots of similarities. For example, did you know, you've seen all these movies about the Romans and whatnot, these early battles. Did you know that the Mel Gibson, who was always shown in the front lines of the battle, would never actually be there? You got someone like Mel Gibson you've invested a lot in. He stays well behind the front. The Romans actually put the cheap labor up front, the expendable farmers with their sticks and stones, and the ants do the same thing. They use the small minor workers, the little cheap labor at the front lines. They move forward the fastest and encounter the prey and get slaughtered. And eventually enough of them show up, though, to pin down the enemy. And only then does the Mel Gibson ant, the big, well-armored one, show up when it's safe and make the death blow. And that assures that their investment in these big soldiers is not harmed.
You were saying that ants will willingly sacrifice themselves for the good of the group. So do they have individual survival instincts at all?
Good question. Certainly, some ants are shyer than others. There are ants like these smaller groups we've talked about, which do not have large-scale warfare. Usually, it's safer in a small group, as it was for human hunter-gatherer groups, to separate and go in a different direction rather than actually get into a huge dispute. And so, but when you get to larger societies, the ants really turn into all-out warriors if need be. I've never seen an ant pause to decide whether it should really go in for the kill. If it's going to bite your toe, it's going to go for it, and it will no doubt be killed for it.
We have another call. Hi, James, go ahead.
Hi, I study slime molds and all that kind of good stuff. And from what you were saying about ants, they're really kind of similar to slime molds.
That's a great question, James, because in fact, I talk about slime molds in my book in a couple of places. One about the way that they actually form the cells get together. It depends on the kind of slime mold. We won't go into the details, but they actually look like army ant raids, some of them, as they sweep forward and eat things like bacteria and so forth. And they actually form groups that at the level of these microbes, these cells, they're often formed from a kind of amoeba-like things. They actually are like army ants or ant colonies in forming an individual that's cohesive and strong, a kind of a superorganism almost. So there are lots of similarities between the two.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and we're talking with Mark W. Moffat, author of Adventures Among Ants. If you have a question, email live@skepticallyspeaking.com or tweet us at Skeptical Radio. And we'll be right back with more after this brief message.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we look at the science of sleep with Dr. Kimberly A. Cote, professor of psychology and director of the Brock University Sleep Laboratory. We'll discuss her research into sleep in the brain and find out how sleep affects our minds and our lives. And on Speaking Up, Josh Hunt of the Cleveland Skeptics introduces us to Critical Thinking 101. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, Friday night at 6 p.m. Mountain Time at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell, and we're here with Mark Moffat, winner of both the Distinguished Explorer Award from the Roy Chapman Andrews Society and the Bowden Medal, Harvard's most prestigious prize for writing, to talk about his newest book, Adventures Among Ants, A Global Safari with a Cast of Trillions. And we have another chat room question.
How far away would worker ants trek from home on a daily basis? Do they stay comparatively close to their colonies, or do they roam farther away? That's from After Three.
How far do worker ants go? Well, it depends on your species. I mean, there are some ants, particularly these small colonies that I mentioned, that they may only go a foot or two or maybe a yard or two from their nest all the time. But there are things like the army ants with their groups of millions and go for, well, hundreds of meters, actually. And the leafcutter ants of South America, again, hundreds of meters. Those usually travel in tight formations for most of the time and separate out for shorter distances to search for food. And so ants often tend to stay together as much as they can until the point of that they have to go out on their own and find their prey.
So let's continue anthropomorphizing, because I enjoy that. Now, you have said that ants actually engage in terrorism as well. There was recently an article on that.
Well, they do have a kind of suicide bomber in one species. This is an ant in Borneo. And it turns out that when it walks up to the enemy, or an enemy comes by it by accident, it literally detonates, extruding a kind of toxic glue all over everything, which kills everything instantly into a kind of tableau of death. And this is a very smart move, probably in certain situations. The ants probably are, in many cases, facing maybe an intruder from another colony that if it gets back and gives the news that there's, hey, we can go and attack this group, they're doomed. It's like a spy in humans. You want to kill it as fast as you can. And I suspect that they do not use this technique at the battlefront. Otherwise, the entire colony would be dead within seconds. So they presumably are a little more thoughtful about it, if they can be thoughtful, or at least they make the right choice at the right times. This is an emergency situation.
I have to point out again, the image that you have in the book is amazing. You know, if, even if people didn't want to know anything about ants, they could just look at the pretty pictures. Really.
Oh, the pretty pictures. Oh, my God. A picture is worth 1,000 words, and I have 1,000 words to back that up.
That
Thanks a lot.
Well put. And ants, actually, continuing with the human parallels, there are certain ants that bury the dead.
Well, there are ants that deal with dead in a number of different ways. There are actually, in some species, specialists that carry out the dead. Usually they don't put them somewhere separately from the rest of the garbage. A few ants separate them out. I'm afraid in many cases the ants that deal with the garbage are in fact the oldest ladies in the colony. Remember, ants are in the social things that you see as ants are all females. So the elderly ladies become, in many cases, the garbage collectors, which may be a point of convenience for the colony. Ants are nothing if well organized. And they, the old ones carry out the garbage until they keel over on the garbage heap and die conveniently there.
Well, considering all this, it's understandable that you're concerned about conservation. Although we've talked quite a bit about maybe the less positive pieces of ants, they can be very beneficial as well, can they not?
Well, that's right. Glad we got to that, Desiree. The ants actually, despite their amazing human-like attributes of aggression as a groups, nevertheless monitor and control the environment under our feet in extreme detail in a way that we don't notice, and does an ecosystem service for us that's hard to even measure or imagine. They are turning over the soil. They're adding nutrients. They are, in many cases, moving seeds to the places that they need to sprout. Many plants, in fact, require ants to bury the seeds at the right place, often in the garbage pile, where, of course, there's a lot of nitrogen and so forth. Other ants actually have been known to pollinate plants, and they actually are essential to the ecologies of many plant species around the world. And this is a part of their life that serves us in around the world, particularly in the tropics, but even up in Canada.
Are there any species that are actually endangered at this point?
Well, there are probably quite a few species that are endangered. Some of these societies that occur in small colonies can be quite rare, and many of them, particularly in tropical zones, are in habitats that are suffering loss, like presents a problem for frogs and other kinds of species. The difficulty for people to imagine that is that some species are actually invasive species that that swarm out from their homelands and take over large parts of the earth, they're kind of the equivalent of humans in the sense that they are conquerors that patrol the ground and enter our homes. And we think of the ants as a problem because of these things, but most of them, most of these kinds of species that you might see in your homes are in fact invasive species from somewhere else. They're problem ants and may give all the other ants a bad name.
So what do you want people to do? Because I don't think I've heard of a Save the Ants Fund. I think they only have those for the cute animals.
Well, this is true, and this is a problem with conservation, because conservation's messages have had to have been focused on sort of the big, cuddly, furry animals, and those aren't found in all the places where the species are richest and most important. So what I try to do is come back with stories that make people fall in love or at least appreciate some of these lesser-known beings. And for National Geographic, I do that with frogs and all kinds of creatures. And those stories provide a framework to make people want to go out and change and make conservation possible. And we need to do a lot more than that. We can't save the world based on the panda alone.
Again, that was succinct. And that's actually all the time we have. Mark, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Desiree, pleasure to be on.
And you can check out all the work that Mark does at drbugs.com. And as always, check us out at skepticallyspeaking.com. From there, you can join our Facebook page, follow us on Twitter, or subscribe to the show in iTunes. And just one last shout out to all the listeners that I was fortunate enough to hang out with at the amazing meeting. It was truly wonderful to meet all of you, and I will definitely see you next year. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
This is Ben Radford from the Monster Talk podcast and Skeptical Inquirer Science Magazine. And I wanted to take a minute to tell you about why science is important. Probably for most of the listeners, it's probably a given that science is important, but I think it's good to take a step back and discuss for a minute why it is. There's many ways of looking at the world and examining the world around us, and science has proven itself again and again the best possible method. We want to understand why the sky is blue, why trees are green, why diseases infect the people they do and how they do. The answers lie in science. That is the way we find out about the world. The answers that often are offered by mysticism and pseudoscience, such as, for example, astrologers claim that they can predict the future and tell people what will happen in their lives months or years or decades down the road. But in fact, if you want to know what will happen, for example, in the heavens, talk to an astronomer. Astronomers can tell you nearly to the precise second when, for example, the next Halley's Comet will be or when celestial events will happen. So if you want to look at prophecy, if you will, or prediction, science is the way to go. And so to my mind, the real benefit of science is its proven track record over and over again, whereas pseudoscience and mysticism really just offer false promises and false hope.
Bring it on. The skeptics await your letter. You call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, break the spell of Pavlov's bells, cause we're skeptically speaking, online reading tarot cards and witches, psychics, and their spoon-bending mind tricks, all the humbug, flim-flam, frauds and shams, the charlatan who, I don't think you understand, it's the hocus-pocus, out-of-focus locus, eroding the brain, making gains on the hopeless, let the crystal ball fall, smash on the floor, leave the pieces alone, we don't need them anymore, just a microscope, telescope, magnifier, reading in between the lines of these lies, bring it on. The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're skeptically speaking.
On Skeptically Speaking, we do interviews with experts on everything from vitamins to paranormal research to evolution to nuclear power. But we also do interviews with people like you. Maybe you've done some research into a specific alternative health treatment and you want to share what you've learned. Or you've written a blog post on some questionable story that's been in the news and you think that people should know about it. Or you've found a creative way to talk to your children about science and you think that it could work for other parents. Or there's a skeptical project that you've been working on and it's time for some promotion. Perhaps you've had an experience where critical thinking saved your bacon and you think that the story might be valuable to other people. These are all great topics for speaking up. You bring the idea, and we'll work with you to make sure that your piece is radio ready. Just send an email to feedback@skepticallyspeaking.com. Put speaking up in the subject line, give us a bit of information about your topic, and we'll contact you. All of us here at Skeptically Speaking are committed to spreading the wonders of science and critical thought. We want to encourage your efforts, and in turn, your segment encourages others. Because we all need some support, and a gentle nudge now and then, to keep questioning everything.